Welcome to OK Talks. I'm your host, Oliver Kendall. I'm a lifelong political nerd with an academic background in international relations focused in security policy and real-world experience working in the U.S. domestic political space and living in a number of other countries than my own, all of which combined, I think, positions me fairly well both to interpret for my international audience what's going on in the politics of my own country and to shed light for some of the folks back home on some events of note going on in the rest of the world.
So, a couple episodes ago, I threw some major shade at Israeli finance minister and human landfill Bezalel Smotrich, who represents some of the worst of what Benjamin Netanyahu's extreme right, borderline fascistic cabinet has to offer. I mean, I ranted for like quite a while, and I stand by everything I said, for the record. This week, though, I feel like I really need to say some things about the just disgusting behavior and some of the other ideological lanes that exist around both this immediate conflict in Gaza and the broader context of the future of Israel and a hypothetical Palestinian state. I plan to do this episode in the aftermath of that giant swipe I took at Bezalel Smotrich as just another take, as I've done in several of the last few episodes of this show. And, you know, having this come right after that, like sequentially, would have been ideal. But the amount of things that I had to say were just too much to fit into an episode with other stuff. This has been part of the reason that I haven't talked on this show about the situation in the Middle East and the broader global implications of the current conflict in Gaza, maybe as much as my background and interests would hypothetically allow, with the exception of episodes 54 and 56 and some in episode 60. There's so much to say that I end up being stalled by the sheer quantity and then decide to not even try for that and other reasons. I can already sense that even just what I want to talk about today will be hard to fit into a reasonable length episode, so I'm going to have to just recognize here in advance that even doing this as a separate episode rather than as just a take that would go with several others, for the sake of time and organization, I'm not going to be able to get anywhere near close to addressing everything that I hypothetically would want to say about this. Now, because this episode is not coming directly on the heels of my tirade against Bezalel Smotrich and Netanyahu's far-right government more broadly, there are a few things that I need to just say off the top here. Firstly, because they're true and I believe them, but secondly, because, well, this is a deeply complicated and super emotionally charged topic. Passions are understandably running very high right now, and I'm guessing there is at least some subset of a hypothetical audience listening to anything on this subject that'll just find it really hard to hear anything else I say without also hearing these truths stated off the top, without me creating a context in which I'm talking about it. So I'm just going to lay this out point by point in no particular order before I get into the main bit of what I want to talk about today. So first, as I've said, I think probably in every episode where I've ever touched this subject, not all criticism of the state of Israel is anti-Semitic. Furthermore, writing off any and all criticism of Israel as anti-Semitic is super counterproductive and definitely undercuts like legitimate claims of anti-Semitism where it does exist. Benjamin Netanyahu, I've also said rather a lot, is I think possibly the single worst human being in elected politics anywhere in the world right now, and if I had my way, he would be loaded onto a rocket and launched directly into the sun. And beyond just Benjamin Netanyahu, the government of Israel has done a number of things wrong. I don't think I need to spell them all out here over the long term in terms of how it's handled the Palestinian Arabs. It's also done a number of things wrong in the short term in terms of how it's handled this war in Gaza militarily, politically, and yeah, morally. And it's made a bunch of terrible mistakes tactically with the really horrible example of the strike on the World Central Kitchen workers the other day being, unfortunately, just the most recent. And it's also made what I see as serious mistakes strategically, not to mention morally and politically, particularly when it comes to like gumming up the works in terms of providing aid, or how they have, or I guess in some ways have just kind of not bothered to, administer the territories that they have managed to take back from Hamas, and the total failure to provide any sort of long-term proposed political solution that would give the people of Gaza the ability to hope for anything besides either continued armed conflict or military occupation or domination by a theocratic terror organization. As Richard Haass, the former chair of the Council on Foreign Relations, keeps saying, you can't replace something with nothing, and the hang on, we're busy fighting now, we'll figure out what happens afterward thing is just not working. Speaking of that need and failure to provide any sort of alternative for the people of Gaza, it has to be recognized by any honest broker here that they're going through hell. suffering a profound humanitarian crisis. I'm not going to call it a genocide, in the same way that we shouldn't misuse the word anti-Semitism to dismiss even legitimate criticism of Israel. We shouldn't misuse and thus dilute the word genocide, which has a very specific definition that this situation, as outrageous as it certainly is, does not meet. Even the International Criminal Court threw out that frivolous case brought a couple months back by South Africa. But that doesn't mean, even if we don't use the word genocide, which we, I would argue, should not, that doesn't mean that the people of Gaza are not suffering an unbelievable trauma. Something doesn't have to be a genocide in order to be a totally unacceptable humanitarian catastrophe, which the situation in Gaza most certainly qualifies as. It's absolutely intolerable. Decent people everywhere in the world should want this to be over as soon as possible, should want civilians in Gaza to stop being killed, have their homes and their lives rebuilt, and most importantly, rebuilt in better conditions also than the horrible ones that they were experiencing before under the kleptocratic theocracy of Hamas and the resulting blockade imposed by Israel and Egypt. Like, the situation can't continue as is. Innocent civilians in Gaza do not deserve what's happening to them right now. They also, I would argue, did not deserve what's happening to them before October 7th. Like, we have to do better than just getting back to the way things were before the Hamas attacks that started this latest war. Now, with that first bit of context having been laid out, there's actually some more context that I have to create in order to talk about what I want to talk about today. Are you starting to see why it's been a bit of a challenge for me to weigh in on this all that much since the war began? So at the top of the episode, I said something to the effect of, like, last week or like a couple episodes ago, I took a swipe at the Israeli far right, and now I want to address some of the really bad behavior coming from other of the ideological lanes in this conflict. And so I want to take a minute here to note my use of the rather awkward term ideological lane as opposed to side when talking about this, and to just address why it is that I'm very intentionally doing that. So I do that because using the word side in this context, as many people are just sort of doing without thinking about it, gives the false impression that what we're seeing in the Middle East right now is a conflict between two sides, Israel versus Palestine, and people will describe themselves as either pro-Israel or pro-Palestine, and demand that you do so as well, that you, like, basically pick a team. And that, I'm sorry, is just bullshit. And if somebody is, like, describing the conflict that way, posting a bunch of stuff on their social media that feeds the narrative that there are two sides, like, this is shirts versus skins, Capulets versus Montague, like, Hatfields versus McCoys, and, like, loudly coming out for or against one imagined side, well, it's a pretty good red flag that you should consider not listening to that person about this anymore. Because, realistically, there are at least three lanes here, arguably more. So I'm going to just, as quickly as I can, lay it out as I see it. Lane number one is made up of those whose goal, whether or not they think it can be achieved in the very short term, is a two-state solution. Spoiler alert, they're the good guys. I'm with them, as is virtually anyone else who wants both a better life for Israelis and Palestinians and knows anything about the history of the conflict. Now, it's a big tent, as we say in U.S. domestic politics. There's a lot of room for disagreement within that camp. People can argue about exactly what the two states look like in the end and where the border gets drawn. People can protest the actions of the Israeli government or call for an immediate ceasefire or believe that Israel should keep fighting until Hamas is totally destroyed. People in this camp can believe that Israel has done nothing wrong ever up to this point or, conversely, that Israel is literally carrying out a genocide as we speak. Again, not correct by the definition of that word, but you see my point. People in this lane can disagree over how soon a two-state solution can realistically happen, or whose fault it is that there aren't already two states, Yasser Arafat and sort of Netanyahu. But fundamentally, those of us who want to see less death, more economic development and long-term stability in the region, those of us whose goal is a realistic settlement that ends the fighting and meaningfully improves life for Palestinians and Israelis, those of us for whom that is the goal mostly understand that the only way we can achieve any sort of peace here is through a two-state solution. So that's lane number one. But lane number two is what I'll call the anti-Arab or anti-Palestine one-staters, the Eretz Israel types exemplified by creeps like Netanyahu and his fascistic allies like the aforementioned Smotrich, who I attacked a couple episodes back. So this group of people support a one-state solution wherein the Palestinian Arabs never get a state. This would mean that they either continue to live under occupation in the West Bank and now perhaps again Gaza after this war, with their territory just continually shrinking to the point of oblivion due to more and more Israeli settlements. Or those people are eventually just ejected and forced to go somewhere else, presumably Jordan or Egypt. Unclear what the sort of anti-Arab one-staters would intend for the roughly 20% of full citizens of Israel proper who are Arabs, including friends of mine. Unclear what they'd want to do with those people. But considering that the sort of anti-Palestine, anti-Arab one-staters are a lot of the same people who basically tried to demolish Israel's independent judiciary last summer, well, probably nothing good. Lane number three is what I'll call the anti-Israel, or, let's be real, usually anti-Semitic one-staters. Now, this lane is made up of a couple of groups. Firstly, not all, but unfortunately a big chunk of the Muslim world, where citizens have for decades been the victims of propaganda by their own authoritarian governments, who often use the existence of Israel to redirect their citizens' anger over domestic issues with their own governments outwards toward the Zionist entity. The second group in this lane is, again, certainly not all Muslims in the West, but definitely at the very least the more vocal Islamists. And then thirdly, a number of non-Muslim useful idiots hailing from the far right because, you know, Nazis don't have a great history with Jews, and yes, from the far left, where unfortunately a number of people, particularly young people who spend too much time on TikTok, have been misled into believing that Israel is, like, literally worse than the pre-Civil War American South or apartheid South Africa, like, basically on par with Nazi Germany, and should thus simply cease to exist, and its people should... Now, unfortunately, this lane, lane number three, the anti-Israel one-staters, is also a very big and diverse camp, but unlike for lane number one, the two-staters, whose proposed solution will be a long, complicated process of negotiating, creating, and then building an independent Palestine and preserving Israel as a secure Jewish democracy, well, lane number three's proposed solution is a lot less difficult to explain, because whether they believe it due to, like, extremist religious anti-Semitism, or right-wing white supremacist anti-Semitism, or because of a fundamental misunderstanding of history, something-something settler colonialism, buzzword-buzzword. Well, the members of lane number three believe that Israel is fundamentally evil, and that unlike all other countries, many of which were founded after Israel under sometimes just as messy circumstances, Israel has no right to exist. And the Jews of Israel need to be punished, either by being yet again expelled from their homeland and sent into exile, or just wiped out. I mean, seriously, those who chant, "From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free," or better yet, "From the river to the sea, Palestine will be Arab," either know they're calling for ethnic cleansing of the Jews of Israel, or have literally never seen a map of the Middle East and thus don't know which river or which sea they're talking about. Now, I suppose I should recognize, while I'm spelling out these lanes, the existence of a fourth one. One that I think increasingly is sort of a non-factor, but out of courtesy, lane number four would be made up almost entirely of very idealistic folks on the left who reject the notion of a two-state solution in favor of a one-state solution, but neither the anti-Arab nor the anti-Jewish one-state solution proposed by lanes two and three as I describe them. Rather, they call for the establishment of a single state that is a multi-ethnic democracy where Jewish Israelis and Palestinian Arabs live peacefully side by side. I think there's a pretty high correlation between people who, after October 7th, still believe this is possible, and people who believe that unicorns might be real, healing crystals actually heal stuff, and Marianne Williamson is a serious presidential candidate. But, you know, there are people out there who still believe a binational two-state solution is possible. I don't think almost any of them live there, but okay. This is at least a group of people who I think genuinely do have good intentions, even if their proposed solution is, in my view, a pipe dream, and I think spending too much time addressing it seriously is, like, actively counterproductive at this point. Before we continue, I want to just remind everybody who hasn't already done so to be sure to subscribe to the show or follow the channel or whatever it is on whichever platform you listen so you don't miss the next episode. Well, I guess if anyone is listening who falls into one of those lanes that I just actively insulted, they probably won't. Fair enough. But I hope the rest of you who, you know, believe in a practical solution and lasting peace in the Middle East will follow the show. And also please be sure to click like and leave a review and all that. It really does help with the algorithm. And most importantly, be sure to share the show with anybody you think might get something out of it. I have a feeling this episode in particular is one that unfortunately needs to be heard as widely as possible. So please do me a favor and do those things. I really do appreciate it. So, lest this entire episode become just me creating context all day without actually getting to what I wanted to talk about from the recent news, like I said off the top, a couple episodes ago I took a swing at members of Lane 2, the, like, Israeli far-right, like, anti-Arab Eretz Israel one-stater lane. This week, I really feel like I have to say something about Lane 3, the anti-Jewish one-stater lane. And right now, I'm not even talking about the actual foot soldiers of that lane. That is to say, Hamas and their less organized cousins, Palestinian Islamic Jihad. Oh, I could talk about the fact that they blew up another ceasefire deal right at the start of Ramadan, and more recently, I believe, turned down yet another ceasefire deal where they were offered something like 800 tried and convicted Palestinian prisoners in exchange for 40 Israeli hostages. I could talk about the fact that the past few weeks saw a bunch of Hamas and PIJ fighters yet again go back and hide inside of and start a fight from the Al-Shifa hospital, which, you know, low-key violation of international law and the laws of war that resulted in a battle around and, unfortunately, pretty comprehensive destruction of yet another hospital which should have been left as neutral territory. I could talk about the video that was just released of a PIJ terrorist who participated on October 7th, describing in cold detail how he raped Israeli women. But I'm not going to get into any of that this episode. In this episode, my primary focus isn't the literal foot soldiers of Lane 3, the anti-Jewish one-stater lane. It's their cheerleaders off the battlefield who I want to talk about today, particularly those privileged enough to be living in the liberal West where they wouldn't ever have to actually suffer under the brutal regime that would be set up by those who they are, whether intentionally or not, shilling for. That is to say, I want to talk in this episode about some of the really shocking and increasingly public anti-Semitism that's been on display in a lot of the world since the Hamas attacks of October 7th that kicked off this horrible war in Gaza. Now, unless I want this episode to last for days, I'm not going to be able to even scratch the surface of the tidal wave of examples of sometimes violent extremism and public anti-Semitism from people from the anti-Israel one-stater lane that I described earlier. That being the case, I think I'll just, in this episode, mention a couple of the recent examples of serious anti-Semitism from a lot of anti-Israel activists, and encourage anyone listening who wants to be an honest broker on this issue to look into more examples. Unfortunately, they won't be hard to find. Now, as I've mentioned previously on this show, even before October 7th, Jews, who, by the way, make up just 2% of the American population, were the victims of 60% of all religious-based hate crimes in the U.S. in a given year. And the U.S. is, by the way, better about this than even most of the rest of the liberal West. And in every country that tracks this sort of thing, incidents of anti-Semitic hate crimes have shot through the roof since October 7th. The first example that I want to point to here is the behavior of a bunch of the protesters outside the giant, like, fundraising event that President Biden held in the last couple of weeks with former Presidents Obama and Clinton. Now, to be fair, there have been tons of examples of anti-Israel protests going way too far, vandalizing Jewish-owned businesses, chanting calls for violence, etc., but I want to point to this one example, partly just because, you know, it was a high-profile event and got a fair amount of attention, and also, it, for me, just sort of crystallized this whole issue. So basically, at this event, protesters outside harassed and sometimes got violent with people who were trying to get to and leave the event, and I'm actually just going to play some of the audio of one woman who I believe it's been confirmed is Jewish being harassed on her way out of the event. So, heads up, there's some language in here. So, just in case anyone didn't understand what's being said there, besides suggesting that this random woman should die for the crime of attending a fundraiser for a Democratic president who's pushing for a ceasefire, well, the guy you hear there in the audio repeatedly called her, and just a heads up, I am going to use the word, so if you want to hit fast forward 10 seconds, he called her a fucking murderous kike, which, for anyone who doesn't already know, is a serious racial slur against Jews along the lines of other such slurs against other ethnic groups that I'm not going to rattle off here. I apologize for using the word, but I think it was necessary for those who maybe didn't understand what was happening there or weren't aware of it. I should say I thought long and hard about whether or not to actually use the word myself, and, well, for anyone who wasn't aware of this before now, all of my ex post facto agonizing as to whether or not to come out and say it should probably make it pretty clear that it's a pretty seriously offensive thing. All of which is to say, yeah, it's kind of hard to view people who do that shit, or who have no problem whatsoever protesting alongside people who do that shit as being motivated by nothing, nothing other than pure heartfelt concern for the welfare of the people of Gaza. Along similar lines, the City Council of Berkeley, California, a little while ago, wanted to do something for Holocaust Remembrance Day, you know, fund some educational programs around the Holocaust or something. As far as I know, Israel had not in any way come up in any of this, but the protesters who showed up in their $4 keffiyehs from Amazon, and no, sorry to my fellow folks on the left who would like for this to just be a right-wing phenomenon, I don't think that these people were Trump or Proud Boy types who somehow found their way into Berkeley. Well, these protesters interrupted the city council and shouted that the members that they were, quote, Zio pigs and money suckers, traitors to America and spies for Israel, and harassed a Holocaust survivor who was in attendance. Again, I doubt this behavior can be attributed to nothing more than heartfelt concern for the suffering of the people of Gaza. And I want to just stress here, these examples that I'm mentioning are hardly even the only ones that I have off the top of my head. I mean, even just with the specific variable of mob interrupts normal order of city councils. Like, I doubt this is the case with most of my audience, but if you're hearing me and thinking, yeah, well, Oliver, this is just anecdotal, Google it. Google it. There's so much more where this came from. If you want some numbers, well, the Anti-Defamation League has reported something like a 330% rise in anti-Semitic events in the U.S. as compared to the same period of time over the last year. Something like almost a 600% spike in Australia. The U.S. Special Envoy on Anti-Semitism has, worked with, I believe, the State Department, has reported multiple hundreds of percentage spikes in anti-Semitism in various Latin American countries. Organizations in European countries have also reported spikes, something like 300% in Austria, 250% in Germany, for example. Definitely been reported in large countries like France and in tiny ones like Denmark, for example. I don't have numbers for here in Spain at my fingertips, but I will say, I've certainly noticed it anecdotally. Now, the next thing I want to mention as we take a look at the rise in anti-Semitism in the West in the time since October 7th is the situation on college campuses, which I've been, for several decades now, a real hotbed of anti-Israel activism. Certainly felt that way back when I was in college, and that anti-Israel activism definitely, at least at times, bleeds over into anti-Semitism. On October 7th, for example, after the rape, murder, and kidnap of Israeli civilians, but before, that is to say, a single Israeli bomb had been dropped on Gaza, you had student groups at high-profile elite institutions like Harvard signing open letters, basically celebrating what had happened and blaming Israel. And in the time since, various groups have reported a rise by multiple hundreds of percent in anti-Semitic incidents on college campuses. I'll give you some more specific numbers in a second. All of which, you know, resulted in the presidents of several elite universities being asked to testify before Congress, and 201 making complete asses of themselves in their weird, like, attempts to obfuscate and dodge responsibility and excuse atrocious behavior by students that they never in a million years would be tolerating targeting any other particular group on campus. At a time when campus administrations have been super ready to, at the drop of a hat, issue public statements about any perceived injustice, well, nothing to say here. More recently, a piece appeared in The Atlantic, a product of reporting over a decent period of time, I believe, that was focused on Stanford specifically, and contained a number of examples worth looking at, but my favorite was one guy who publicly called for President Biden to be murdered for supporting a quote-unquote genocide. Now, some people responding to the article tried to pass this off as, yeah, well, it's just some kid who accidentally said a dumb thing. No, it's not. The guy is 23, a teaching assistant, I believe, employed by the university, and as far as I know, he has not lost that position. And this was not, like, a one-off mistake. I'm pretty sure this person has come out in public and repeatedly defended that statement. So, just to conclude the campus part of this episode spotlighting the rise in anti-Semitism since October 7th with a couple of numbers here. Well, the Anti-Defamation League, by coincidence, had, before October 7th, conducted surveys of how Jewish students felt on college campuses before, and then they went back and did them again after October 7th. So, in the first survey, 67% of Jewish students said that they felt physically safe on campus. In the second one, that number was 46%. In the first survey, 65% of Jewish students felt that their university was welcoming and supportive of Jewish students. After October 7th, that number was 46%. In the wake of October 7th, the percentage of Jewish students who were comfortable with other students knowing they were Jewish dropped from 64% to 39%. 73% of Jewish students reported that they have either seen or been on the receiving end of some sort of anti-Semitic attack in this current school year. In another education-related issue here, a giant teachers union in Massachusetts, a union that represents more than 100,000 people, mind you, hosted an event put on by a couple of extremist anti-Israel professors. And no, the fact that they also invited somebody from the weird fringe group Jewish Voices for Peace does not in any way undercut my characterization of the professors as extremist anti-Israel. Seriously, just Google JVP or read the Anti-Defamation League's blurb about them. They are, like, not above board at all. So, right, this union hosted an event with a couple of extreme anti-Israel professors, one of whom, several weeks after the October 7th mass rape, mass kidnapping, and mass occur, had written an op-ed basically cheering about the attack. This event also pushed messaging that delegitimized Israel's right to exist, and the idea that anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism are not in any way connected ever at all. So I'm just going to take a second here to say something that I probably should have up at the top with all the context, but forgot to. One of the more annoying things about the past few months is the extent to which the word Zionism has become some sort of slur, some sort of, like, dirty word that people want to use when criticizing the Netanyahu government, or worse, as an excuse to be anti-Semitic. I'm not anti-Semitic, I'm an anti-Zionist. Here's the thing, though. Zionism, at its core, it's nothing more than the belief that Jews have a right to have a state in their ancestral homeland. Like, that's it. It's the same rationale that says that the Swedes have a right to a state in Sweden or the Japanese have a right to a state in Japan. Now, are there Zionists who believe that that state should encompass a whole bunch more territory than Israel has right now and want to eject the Palestinians and annex Gaza and the West Bank? Well, sure. But there are also people who believe that feminism means hating men and relegating them to second-class citizenship. But we who are feminists, who, by the basic definition of feminism, advocate for women's rights because we believe in gender equality, don't simply allow crazy people to define feminism and take that word away from us, no more than those of us who believe in the fundamental idea that Jews have a right to some sort of state in their homeland should allow the word Zionism to be twisted into something else. So, just to tie back to the lanes that I described up near the top, lane 2, the anti-Palestine one-staters, they don't own the word Zionist. Anyone in lane 1, the two-staters, is just as much a Zionist. If you believe in an independent Palestinian state and you also believe at the same time that Israel has a right to exist in freedom and security, well, congratulations, you're a Zionist. Welcome to the team. Like, sure, there are different, I don't know, tribes among Zionists, but at its core, Zionism today means believing that Israel has a right to exist. Full stop. That's it. With that being the case, I would argue that being a Zionist doesn't even, like, preclude one from being uncomfortable with some of what happened around Israel's founding. I mean, the United States, well, basically every country in the Americas, and many countries in other parts of the world as well, exists basically as the product of having come to a territory they didn't have a lot of real claim to, oppressed or eliminated the natives, and then built the country on the back of slave labor. I mean, it's way worse than anything Israel's founders are accused of having done. And in Israel's case, well, Jewish people were actually indigenous to the region, and many already lived there and had done so for like 800 years prior to having been kicked out the first time. I mean, hell, even just in the time since Israel was founded, multiple other countries have come into existence as the product of way more violence and death than was ever the case with Israel. But I don't hear anybody saying that the Balkan states should be dissolved and replaced with new Yugoslavia, or that Pakistan and Bangladesh should simply cease to exist. If you're not at least a little uncomfortable with how most countries came into existence, well, you're either a sociopath or don't know much history. And none of this is meant to gloss over the problems with the founding of Israel or to excuse what's happened with the Palestinians in the time since and what's happening in Gaza right now. But it does seem that only in the case of this one country is it considered, you know, an acceptable political position that, yeah, I think that country should be abolished. So, is being quote-unquote anti-Zionist the same as being anti-Semitic? Well, maybe not always, but you gotta try real hard to not see at least a bit of a correlation there. All of which is to say, just to tie back to where we came from before I move on, yeah, I would say that an event hosted by a teachers' union with more than 100,000 members, put on by someone who wrote a column salivating over October 7th and pushing a narrative that there is no correlation ever between anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism, and encouraging teachers to push that narrative on the kids in their classroom? Well, yeah, I think that certainly does belong up on the shelf with all the other examples of the rising tide of anti-Semitism in the Democratic West. So I'm going to try to have this episode not go on much longer. There were like two more things that I was planning to talk about. Like, I originally planned to circle back to something I started discussing back in episode 56 of this show about the way the war in Gaza is being covered in the press, but I think I'll keep this one focused primarily on the spike of anti-Semitism since October 7th rather than on the war itself. Maybe I'll do a spin-off episode. But before I wrap up here, doing this episode about the, again, rampant and rising anti-Semitism that's been showing itself lately, I'm just sort of anticipating a couple of questions that somebody might ask me after hearing what I've said so far, or questions people actually have already asked me in other contexts. So I want to just head a few of those off at the pass right now. One might be, Oliver, why are you so much more concerned about discrimination against Jews than you are about discrimination against, say, Muslims or Hindus or Christians or Sikhs or any other religious group? Well, first of all, there's the quantitative difference. At least in the US, and I'm sure it's also true in other parts of the liberal West as well, anti-Semitism is just orders of magnitude more common than active discrimination against any other religious group. I mentioned earlier that stat that even before October 7th in the U.S., where Jews make up just 2% of the population, 60% of the religious-based hate crimes in a given year are committed against Jews. And in the time since October 7th, well, seriously, I've cited other numbers earlier than this episode, but just Google anti-Semitism since October 7th. You'll find a fucking laundry list of articles about by how many hundreds of percentage points anti-Semitic hate crimes have spiked across most of the world. You'll notice I also chose to talk just about right now and not even bother to mention the several thousand years of, well, you know. Second, in addition to the quantitative piece, and this I'm not going to get into as much here because it's worth another entire episode by people who are way more qualified than me, there are various qualitative differences between anti-Semitism and discrimination against other religious groups, not least because Jews are not actually only a religious group, but again, I'm going to leave most of that for others who are more qualified than I am. Another perfectly valid question might be, Oliver, why are you so concerned about attacks on Jews when the people of Gaza are going through hell right now? Okay, first of all, Jews, in general, are not responsible for what's happening in Gaza. Blaming Jews in general for everything Israel does? That's anti-Semitism. Second, we need to be able to keep two thoughts in our head at the same time. I'm horrified by the situation in Gaza. I think I made that pretty clear up at the top of the episode, but just in case I didn't, I am. I want the war to end, for the Palestinian people in general to have a state, and for the people in Gaza in particular to have their homes and lives rebuilt. But we who are horrified by what's happening don't have that much ability to change the situation on the ground right now. As recent weeks should have made really clear, the Biden administration, although it's more and more openly putting pressure on the Netanyahu regime, does not have the ability to dictate policy to the Israeli government. I wish Joe Biden were the Prime Minister of Israel. Frankly, I think quite a lot of Israelis right now do too. But he's not. And interrupting his speeches and calling him Genocide Joe isn't going to fix the problem. Nor is threatening to vote for Trump, either by voting for him directly or by voting for a third party or not voting, which comes down to the same thing. Trump will not help. Bottom line, as I say, although we who want to fix this in the long term should make it absolutely clear that we support a two-state solution, freedom and dignity for the Palestinians, safety for the Israelis, we don't have that much control over the situation on the ground. We on the liberal left do, however, have the ability to decide whether, in our anguish over the humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza, we choose to align ourselves with people whose motives are not pure. People who aren't necessarily angry about a humanitarian crisis so much as they are about the idea that the Israelis are the ones behind it. People who would call the current situation a genocide with the implication that that's a bad thing, but then suggest that the 7 or so million Jews of Israel from the river to the sea, quote-unquote, should be expelled if not exterminated. People whose rage about the situation is not over the fact that it's happening so much as the fact that it's happening to the people of Gaza rather than the people of Israel. People who cheered on the rape, torture, kidnapping, and by-hand murder of more than 1,000 Israeli civilians, or at least justified it as some sort of glorious act of resistance, or are trying to whitewash it in retrospect now. And if your response to that is, oh, Oliver, not everyone out there protesting Israel right now is like that, yes, granted, I'm not saying they all are. But enough are that it's worth paying attention. And it's worth all of us on the liberal left, progressives, whatever word we want to use to describe ourselves, taking an affirmative stand and saying, I'm with the innocent Palestinian Arab civilians who just want a better life and to no longer be in a war zone. But I'm not with Hamas. I'm not with protesters from New York to Sydney chanting gas the Jews or bomb bomb Tel Aviv or any flavor of the from the river to the sea thing. And although I may be left of center, I am not with weird fringe leftists using academic buzzwords to try to delegitimize the very existence of the State of Israel and in so doing imply that the people don't have a right to be there, with whatever implications may follow from that logic. All that, that should not be a difficult position for us to take, and shame on us if it is. Not all criticism of Israel is anti-Semitic, but it shouldn't be that hard to deplore the humanitarian nightmare in Gaza without being anti-Semitic, or aligning with people who, if we're honest with ourselves, pretty obviously are. Because really, if someone's demonstration of solidarity with the people of Gaza involves, like, picketing the Holocaust Museum, or harassing Jewish students on campus, or tearing down posters of Jewish hostages, or spray-painting swastikas on synagogues, or tossing a brick through the window of a local Jewish-owned business, well, then let's be real. It was never just about the policies of the Netanyahu government or the suffering of Palestinian civilians. Probably there's also something else going on there. And you know, we have several thousand years worth of history to give us a hint as to just what it might be. That's it for this episode of OK Talks. If you like the show and want to make sure not to miss the next episode, be sure to follow on whatever platform you listen or shoot me an email at oktalkspodcast@gmail.com to be added to the email list. I just want to reiterate what I keep saying in every episode. Please do feel free to reach out to me if you have ideas for the show, a topic you'd be interested in hearing me weigh in on, somebody you think I should have on. I can't always promise that I'll be able to answer or very quickly, but I do mean it. I'd love to hear from you. oktalkspodcast@gmail.com. If you really want to do me a solid, please do go ahead and share the show with anybody you think might get something out of it. To anybody who already has, thank you. To anybody who will, thanks in advance. Thanks as always to Nate Wright for having designed the podcast artwork and to everyone else for listening.